Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello. My name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
Hello and welcome to episode number 88 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. I hope you're all well and not being affected too much by the current lockdown restrictions. Today's podcast was actually recorded during a studio visit, face to face and not over Zoom like most of them have become. Today's guest is a world-renowned sculptor who creates work on an industrial scale, was awarded an RA and is an absolute all-round lovely guy. It is, of course, Richard Wilson. I've known Richard for quite a few years and was lucky enough to work with him on one of his projects, which was called Butterfly, which we speak about in detail and construction. Wilson has exhibited widely, nationally and internationally, for over 30 years and has made major museum exhibitions and public works in countries as diverse as Japan, USA, Brazil, Mexico, Russia, Australia, and numerous countries throughout Europe. Wilson has also represented Britain in the Sydney, Sao Paulo and Venice Biennale. He was nominated for the Turner Prize on two occasions. He was one of a select number of artists invited to create a major public work for the Millennium Dome in 2000. Wilson was, in 2004, appointed Visiting Research Professor at the University of East London. In 2006, he was elected as a member of the Royal Academy, and in 2008 was awarded an honorary doctorate at the University of Middlesex. And I'm sure he'll be the first to admit, appearing on the Ministry of Arts podcast tops all of them. At the end of this podcast, I will be telling you once again about the limited edition barbed wire stars that I've got for sale, and also giving you the heads up on a new art podcast that will be coming out on the 20th of October. So please, come with me into the studio of Mr. Richard Wilson.
Well, it's a very interesting time, as we've been just discussing, COVID. You know, a lot of my colleagues are finding it very difficult to find work. But my phone is still ringing, and I'm still getting emails. And not everything is, you know, going to be a party. But basically, I've got a one-person show, a solo show, opening in February 2021 in Istanbul.
Nice.
In a big commercial gallery out there, Paul Vanelli Gallery. So I'm working on collating the drawings, the prints and the sculptures for that. But they are all object-based. So it's an interesting one for me. I mean, my reputation's based on the big work, but this is going to be an interesting commercial space, commercial gallery, and something I haven't done a lot of, so I'm intrigued by that. So that's keeping me busy. On top of that, I've got lots of little bits and pieces. There's an organisation called Plinth. They're wanting a couple of sketches for a portfolio to produce as a multiple. And that's happening late this year. And then I've got my own project. I made years ago a piece of work in 2000 called The Slice of Reality, which is a section of shit out at Greenwich. Well, it's been out there now for sort of 20 years, basically. And it's time to start thinking about what to do with it. It's costing me to keep it there. It's still yours. It's still mine. Yeah, I got given it. Once the gig was over, you know, there was 3 years where it belonged to the organisation. And then they, as it were, sold it to me for a peppercorn, thinking I'd get rid of it. But I've kept it going. I ran it as an office for many years. Then I had it as a bit of a studio space, but that didn't work. It gets cold and damp in the winter. And then my son was on board for a while. He's a musician, so he was using it for band practice and stuff like that. But now it's surplus to requirements. So I've been thinking about it. And I've got a very dear friend who lives down in Cornwall who is getting on now. And he's the owner of the largest collection of steam whistles in the world. He's got like 14 million quid's worth of steam whistles. And they're all these lost voices, meaningful utterances that are all silent. And I said, I'm going to make a steam whistle museum for you. I'm going to donate my ship. If you want to donate your stuff, we'll start talking to some people and get some money. So I'm actually working on a suite of drawings to be able to go and start meeting people and saying, look, this is going to be a big new museum. Not necessarily in London, for whoever's interested.
Are you going to move it from where it is?
We can cut it, because it's 70 foot high, it's 33 feet wide, and it's 29 feet deep. It's a section. It's a bit like a loaf of bread being the ship, and you take a slice out of it. That's what the slice of reality is. But it's big enough for all his whistles, but we're going to make it a live museum. I know someone in Rotterdam who builds steam boilers who's interested in donating a boiler. And if we can get it all kitted out and find the money to do it, it'll be open to the public. But we want it as a live museum in that, you know, I want to blow off twice a year, maybe once at winter and once in the middle of summer. That's kind of getting very difficult with all the PC going on, political correctness. Yeah. Church bells are dying out. You know, people are moaning about the sound of church bells, which is ridiculous. But if we can get a blow off happening, you know, imagine kids pulling these strings or these chains and seeing 40-foot plumes of steam going and your chest all rattling away with the note. So I'm working with a couple of artists who are production company on that one called Satorsky and Satorsky. And Thomas and Angel are very good at talking to people and finding money. So it's a case of finding where we can put it. You know, it could go to Liverpool Dock, it could go to Newcastle, it could go to Glasgow, it could stay in London. We're just going to find where the interest is and donate it, you know, but we'll need the money to do it.
Because I presume the upkeep is
well, the upkeep huge, won't be that difficult. I mean, the ship itself structurally is in really good shape, but it's all the detail work that's needing a little bit of care. What we can do is take that out and replace it, or remove some of it, like pipe work. It's not necessary to have all the pipe work. And we can expand it in some way, in that obviously there's going to be a difficulty getting the public on board because it's all ladders and stuff like that. So we might, some of the designs I'm looking at is extending the ship slightly in glass as a framework, so it copies what the original ship was like. But that would mean you could put a lift in there, you could have a bit of disability stuff going on, maybe some toilets, and even, you know, I'm not sure if you want eating and drinking, but you want to get a coffee there. Yeah. So it's basically to see if that project has got any mileage. And the way to do that is I've got to make some drawings and models and have those done by early, middle next year. You know, I'm aiming for Easter, and then make the big push after Easter to see if we can get that to happen.
Because I could imagine cities like you're saying, Liverpool, down the docks and that, I think it'd be quite easy for the councils to agree to that.
Yeah,
because it's such a...
Yeah, I mean, what it'd be is a site. What we'd have to do is we'd have to get an area, not that big actually, but we'd have to have some services in. We'd have to have water, electricity, etc. And then we'd have to have a bit of a delivery site where we could get fuel in depending on how the boiler would work. You know, we're talking oil fired at the moment, which means we'd have to have an oil tank underground. You know, so there's a little bit of tickety booing to happen to put the infrastructure in, just to then sit her down. What we'd do is we'd have a cradle made for her, for the ship, and it means it could be cut in four sections, delivered to whatever city, welded up or bolted up, and then dropped in, and then it becomes a museum for that city to sort of be proud of, and you don't even have to go there, you can hear it miles off.
You can hear it coming. Well, I should say, as we're speaking at the moment, if anyone hasn't realised, we're with Richard Wilson. We first met round about 2002, when you was working, or you was brought into the university. You was using the University of East London space.
That's right. I was given a 2-year research fellowship, and I was introduced to the sculpture department and met yourself and Lee and a few other people. And I came for that 2 years, and in that 2 years, I thought I'd do my own work, but at the same time, it would only be fair for me to interact by having a project where I could engage with a group of students. Yeah. You know, not everyone, obviously, but there'd be a group of people who might be interested in helping me out on a project. And that project took place in 2003, which was my last year with the UEL Fellowship. And we went to Wapping Project Space. It was then run by Jules Wright. Unfortunately, she passed away with cancer a couple of years ago.
I didn't know of that space at that time. What amazing space it is.
Yeah, it was an absolutely beautiful space. Currently, it's empty. It is owned, but currently it's empty and awaiting redevelopment. And I think the guy who's now got ownership of that space is talking about probably reintroducing something of Jules's ideas, you know, a restaurant and a space for, you know, art events to take place. So hopefully that will come back in. But yeah, we got that project together, and I can talk about that.
With Butterfly, you brought in a Cessna aeroplane, and I know a lot of people helped, but I know that it was me and Lee and a guy called Mark who was in the
Mark was there
us.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, it was the three of us were sort of there more than
the main
most,
yeah.
And it involved us sort of stripping the paint off the plane and buffering it up, and then one Saturday afternoon in the car park, brought in a load of
I mean, what happens? I'll give you a little bit of potted history about the idea. I mean, what happens to artists is when they get going, it's all very exciting. They come out of college and they're finding themselves. They're trying to find ideas. But as you become more professional, you start to sort of get into fixes, and fixes being, you know when your party pieces are working, you know you could just sit back and probably just do that and make some money or whatever. So you're not really pushing and testing yourself as an artist, which is, you know, really where you should be. It does mean you taking risks, but I believe that's what art is about. It's about taking risks. So I was beginning to think, I knew what I was doing as an artist, and I was probably sitting back a bit, not necessarily being lazy, but I was just sort of ticking along and it was all fun, but I wanted something that would really test me. So I was trying to get back to, like, first principles of making. You know, what is the creative act? What is a creative act? How can I do something that I've never done before that I'm not trained at doing, where I could surprise myself and excite myself? Anyway, complete accident, sheer fluke. One day I put my hand in my pocket, having washed my jeans, and I pulled out a fiver that had all screwed up. It had been through the washing machine. And I thought, Jesus Christ, that's a five. You know, that's a lot of money for me. And so what you do is you start unfurling it. Yeah. And, of course, it starts tearing. So you turn it round, you start somewhere else. And I started, and as I was doing this, I was thinking, this is like an idea. This is an idea in it. This is the first principles of a creative act, how to unfurl something that's screwed up.
Yeah.
We're not trained. No one's ever been trained to do that. Yeah. Maybe a panel beater straightening out a car that's been in a crash is as close as you'll get it. Or, you know, when you've sort of like probably poured all your oil paint out of a tube and rolled it right up, you open it out again and cut the end off and look inside, see if there's a tiny little bit of white or red left inside. So those kind of acts that aren't really art, but as a process can be if you can apply them in some way. So this started a series of drawings and models, which is always how an idea gets going. And I decided upon buying a Cessna aircraft, just the body, you know, the wings and the body. None of the guts inside, none of the mechanics, as it were. And I found a guy down in Surrey somewhere who had a couple of fields, and it was full of old... He bought insurance stuff, you know, that was written off, so he could buy an aeroplane, take the wings off and sell the wings, that sort of thing, or a propeller or whatever. So I went and got a load of bits and pieces which made up a Cessna light aircraft, and then brought all those bits, as you well now know, Gary, brought those to UEL where I was based, and we bolted it all together and checked it all out that it was going to, you know, be an aeroplane that we could crush. Then we stripped it and then actually then took all the paintwork off, because what I wanted to do is I wanted a glistening, like an insect. I wanted something that was recognisable as an aeroplane, obviously, initially, but I didn't want it with all the paintwork and the signage and stuff. I just wanted the metal, the polished metal. Yeah. So we went through that laborious task of weeks of bloody... It started with nitrimals, and we all got a bit worried about what went down the drain. So we got some sort of friendly stuff in and stripped all the paint off. Then we buffed it up, bolted it all together. And I remember wheeling it out into the car park, and we had a look at it, and it was a beautiful thing, the paint off it. It was a bit like the first Mercedes racing car where they sanded all the paint off.
It turns, doesn't it, from a plane to a sculpture?
Yeah. It started to lose its identity and just be a form at the end. And then the next problem was like, okay, it's going to if we're unfurling something, we then need to crush it first to be able to unfurl it. Yeah. So how do you crush an aeroplane? And I thought what we'll do is we'll get 4 forklift trucks in, and I'll build some big sort of ramming devices on the front of them and get these people to just sort of fold it up for me. But of course, an aeroplane... I hadn't thought about it. I mean, these things are designed to actually protect the occupant when you're up in the air. You know, you don't want to die coming down in one of these things. So they're rather like origami. When you look at the metalwork inside, they're folded in such a way as to keep the integrity of the structure there when it hits something, if it lands, badly. So I remember we had to go in and saw a couple of bits and whack it. I remember you with a sledgehammer. Because these forklift truck guys, they got very excited. They were ramming it, but their trucks were getting beaten up. Yeah. And the aeroplane wasn't really getting mashed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, they've got to be 2 tonne each, haven't they?
They've got to be. Yeah, and they were running at them, weren't they? They were really smashing at it, but it wasn't. And I was getting a bit panicked. That's why we had to sort of undo a few bits. But then we finally, at the end of the day, it was a long, exhausting day, but we got it into a big lump. But then the problem was, like, how do we get it to Wapping? And I remember driving home, and I came up at the traffic lights, and there was a scaffold lorry full of lads, and I said to Mia, do you want to earn a couple of quid? I've got a lump of metal, I need to get it from the Galleons Reach way, from the university, to Wapping Project Space in Wapping. And I said, yeah, 40 quid, we'll do it. And I met them at the car park. I don't know if you remember being there, but there was this pile of metal. And they jumped out and they started dragging it along the floor. And I said something which completely floored them. I said, please don't drag it like that. You'll scratch it. And they're looking at me as if I'm completely mad.
That's where the two worlds
meet. And it's like, my hand on that plane is my hand. Yeah. I made it that screwed up form because I had an image of it. That scratch they're putting on it isn't part of my plan. Yeah. I don't want this thing screwed up. So they looked at me as if I was completely mad.
It's a bit of metal, mate.
Anyway, they put a wad in their pocket and they dropped it off at Wapping. And then the lump was hung in the space. And over a period of 3 and a bit weeks, we worked together, didn't we, as a core team with hydraulic equipment and ratchet straps, 2-ton ratchet straps. And we started to pull that plane out with me having no real clear idea exactly what the end result was going to be. But what we did, or what I did do, is I employed a couple of guys to come and install time-lapse photography that fired down on really primitive computer stuff. Every 5 minutes, a camera went off from a movie camera and also from a still camera. And the movie camera, you like yourself, you have 2 in case one breaks down. But also the movie camera meant that I could get the sound.
Yeah.
I could get a moment of sound as well as a moment in visual.
And everyone beneath it was wearing red hard hats.
And it was all
you
bird's eye view.
One, did you?
I had a red one. Yeah, we all had red. Different. And of course, what happened is every 5 minutes there was like a click, click, a click, click, day and night. And after about 3.5 weeks, we'd got the aeroplane out. And by then, I was just beginning to think, what is all this about? And what sculpture is very good about is it's very good about talking about mass, but it's not very good about talking about time. Whereas cinematography and still photography, we can talk a little bit about time much better. And I realised all every day, going at the end of the day with a big stick, you know, with all the images up to a bigger computer upstairs to park them up there, because this computer downstairs that was holding them for a day just wasn't big enough to get... it was too low to fill up. So I realised what we had is a compression of time. Here I was with a compressed object pulling it out, and I'd actually then got all this compressed, all these moments. If I could compress them into a film, I'd have the history of that aeroplane unfurling over 3 weeks in 3.5 minutes, as it turned out. Yeah. And the piece was cut from all its strops and it crashed to the ground like a swatted gnat. And overnight we built that screen. And the next day people came in, because they'd been witnessing the unfurling. The next day they came in, the plane was like behind a screen and you're in darkness. And there was just this movie called Butterfly. And it was like this, all these weird sounds, you know, voices and machinery and tools all playing out in 3.5 minutes. With this thing just opening and then back to beginning and opening and
with
back
the
to beginning.
With the worker ants buzzing around.
Yeah, with everybody. And we were like worker ants or something. Yeah. You know, it was a very insect-type piece of work in the relationship to how, you know, bees work or insects work. We were all working around this mothership, this aircraft, to pull it back out.
Because what was interesting for me, although I was a part of it from, you know, the start to the end, I'd never seen a... Obviously, I'd never seen a major piece of work like that come to fruition. And it was beautiful to see that you had the initial idea, the end... You knew what you wanted at the end. You sort of knew how to get there, but every part of it was a journey for you as well. Because
yeah,
you was
yeah.
never sure. And yeah. when we come up against problems, or when you come up against problems, the thing that I've really admired and I've taken on myself after that was that we had Richard Wilson, who we was all looking up to, turn around to us and go, "What do you reckon? How can we get around this problem?"
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it was you yeah. was really making it our work,
yeah.
you know?
Well, it's the Beatles, isn't it? Try with a little help from my friends, you know. You have a problem, but it's a shared situation. And I've always used the plural we.
Yeah.
You know, I do a lot in my work, only because the scale of it means it's not me. I might have the initial idea, but it's we that put it together. Yeah. We being the plural, engineers, fabricators, whoever I employ or whoever working with me as team, we can get this thing done. And as I said, we're not trained in unfurling.
No,
smashed up aeroplanes or anything that's been crushed. How do you pull it back out? The fiver was the learning curve, but at the same time, you then have to jump to a different scale and a different material. It's still the same act, you know, unfurling and pulling out. But when it's metal and you've got equipment and hydraulics, you need a couple of people to be holding things while you're getting something in, and then they're on it doing their bit. And it's a very, very shared situation. And in that respect, all the aesthetic decisions were shared as well. Yeah. It wasn't like my ego was dictating. Because sometimes I was actually thinking, well, you know, where is this going? What are we doing with this thing? You know, what should we... Let's get it up there and start turning it around a bit. And then someone will say, right, OK, let's pull it on this one. I'll put my strop up here. So we were sharing a situation.
Yeah.
It's like going up a mountain with a load of people. You know, you don't have... You'll have one who might come forward as being more knowledgeable. But at the end of the day, we're all packing in there and trying to sort of get something done collectively. Yeah. And we even did that with the food, the lunch breaks. We were all chipping in. It wasn't like I was sitting back waiting, who's made my sandwich? everyone was doing it for everyone else, weren't we? It was great. I remember that lad who taught me how to make a proper decent coffee out of instant powder, you know. And it's all about how much powder you put in, and then a tiniest bit of coffee, tiniest bit of milk, and you have to really whisk it to foam it all up, and the temperature, the water had to be just right. And I was thinking, I'm really getting something from this project. I know how to make coffee.
When you was growing up, was your art in your family?
Yeah. My dad was an artist, and my mum had been to art school. And I think, although he never encouraged it, I grew up in an environment where he made constructions. And I always thought, oh, God, that smells great. You know, I could watch the alchemy of him putting a stick with bristles on it into colour and picking it up and putting it on a bit of shaped plywood that had a bit of canvas glued on it, and he'd scumble the paint in. And when he'd go out the room, I'd pick it up and I'd have a dab as well. And I'd hear him come back, I'd put the brush down. And I wonder if he'd see my bit, you know. So, yeah, I grew up in that environment. There were always books around. I remember being a young kid and being really scared of looking at the Goya prints in the book. And when my parents used to go, I used to get the Goya book and go, that guy's put that fork through all those people and eaten them. And all the horror of that Goya imagery. But he never encouraged it. He just used to say, if you're going to do anything, do it to the best of your ability. And I've always remembered that. If you're going to do something, you might as well do it well. And I was thought I'd do a big, become a graphic designer. I went to the London College of Printing in 1970 at Elephant and Castle. And I did a foundation course there. And it was all letter set then. There was no computers or anything. Yeah. You know, you'd have to draw and do letter setting and typesetting stuff out. And I thought, this is all okay, but it's too... It was too two-dimensional. It was too flat. Yeah. And I realised what I really wanted to do is I wanted to be dealing with stuff in my hands. I wanted to make things. I'd always been a maker, you know, I'd always done models and stuff like that. And then when I got to 16, I bought a big motorbike and I pulled it all apart, rebuilt it, and I went off down to Cornwall. I gave up with school. I finished in the fifth year. I didn't do sixth form. I didn't do A-levels or anything. I went off and built surfboards.
Nice.
I was fiberglassing down there. I was repairing. I had all the sidecar that I had on this big motorbike, an old M20, had all the fiberglass gear, and I made myself quite a lot of money, actually, and I was drawing all the decals, the transfers. I used to go to the local bread shop and get the tissue paper, and I'd sit all day and do decals for people, and then I'd glass them into the boards.
Yeah.
And so I had all my drawings, you know, people would buy them and put them, and I'd, you know, have them done. And that sort of set the plan for sort of making. So when I finished London College of Printing, I went to Hornsey College of Art, as it was then, which is now, I think, Middlesex University. Yeah. It did go Middlesex Polytechnic, then University, as these things do and change and develop. And then from there, 74 to 76, I did a postgraduate course in a rather monastic existence on the London Road site of the Reading University. But it was a great 2 years. I mean, it was solitary in one sense. Yeah. There weren't many of us on the postgraduate course, and it was, you know, the sculpture bit. The workshops were at one end of the university, and my studio was at the other. So you tended to keep yourself to yourself. There was a bit of social life, obviously, in the evenings being university, but that was really good as well. And it was very different to, you know, the kind of craziness of Hornsey College of Art and what we all got onto there, you know, at Alexandra Palace. And then from there, I moved to Butler's Wharf in 1976 and got myself a studio. Came back to London because I was a Londoner. Came back to London, I thought, I'm going to make myself a career in art. There wasn't a lot going on. There wasn't a lot of commercial galleries then. You could probably count them on two hands, you know, probably 10 commercial galleries.
I don't think a studio in Butler's Wharf would be too cheap nowadays, would it?
Well, Butler's Wharf, I mean, Conran bought it all, and it finished in 1984. Well, I finished there in 1982. But when I went in there, I got a 3,000 square foot space on the top floor but one, in W Block at Butler's Wharf with a view out over the river, and it cost me 127 quid a year.
Fucking hell.
3,000 square foot.
And
that would be a square foot now.
Shit. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely amazing. I mean, I've gone full circle. I've come here. I've got a very good landlord. I'm out in Erith. And he's been very, very fair and honest with me and straightforward. And as you can see, opposite, it's derelict. He's trying to make... He's put me in here as a bit of bait to see whether he can get all of that going. So I'm going to help him out on that one.
Nice.
And I've got friends I know who would be interested in some spaces here. But I'm on a very, very small rent here, and I've got a couple of thousand square feet. I've got a workshop downstairs.
What are they putting small units in here, artist units?
Well, at the moment, it's all empty and open across there.
Because you've got just down the road there at Woolwich.
Yeah.
Richardson's down there.
Yeah.
And that's a massive big community.
Yeah. That's big space. Yeah, Thameside Studios. Yeah, I know a few people who are in there. What they tend to do is they tend to get these spaces and then they chop them right up so they make little pods within them. I'm talking to Jack all about how this could be left a little bit more open, in that, you know, people I know are looking for space, they're looking for like 1,000, 2,000 square feet, but they can't afford, when I say London prices, we're still in London here at Erith, but they can't afford those silly, crazy prices that I was paying.
Yeah.
Network Rail, you know, I mean, they were just creaming it, and that they weren't really giving that much back as far as I was concerned as a landlord. And I gave up with them in the end. I was priced out by them.
Well, when Gavin Turk moved about 2 years ago or yeah. so, maybe three, he went from where he was in Hackney Wick.
Yeah, yeah.
He just crossed over the road, more or less, over into Canning Town. Years ago, he had like old scrap merchants. And
I remember it.
And
yeah.
he's just smack in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Made a studio amongst it. And yeah. when I last saw him, I was like, you know, how are you getting on with the guys around you?
Yeah.
Because I could imagine him, well, like you were saying, with the scaffolders.
Yeah.
You know, they just know metal is, you know, £30.
Yeah. They know how to weigh it in, exactly. But they don't know it's sculpture.
But he was saying he gets on fine with everyone around yeah. him, you know. He yeah. himself said, you know, he's the crazy artist.
Yeah. Well, that's a bit like here, but we've got great people either side. You know, we've got Vikram next door, and he's going through some very difficult times because of the COVID shutdown. Yeah. You know, he's got shipments that are held up in ports and stuff like that. You know, and I've seen his company really suffer, you know, yeah. with the fact that customers aren't buying. You know, he deals with luggage. Well, if you cut travelling out in a country, yeah, who's right. going to buy? Who wants to go and buy a suitcase? Yeah. So I've seen people around me suffer, and I'm feeling strangely quite privileged in my career, in my profession, that I'm still able to sort of sit and dream. I've got a bit of savings. I'm able to. If I sit here for a week and don't make any money, I haven't lost because I've been dreaming.
Yeah.
And I've been creating, and I've got backup. I've come up with an idea, and I've put that on the back burner. So if someone phones me next year, I can say, yeah, I've got a couple of ideas. I've been working hard whilst we've had shutdown, you know, lockdown. So, yeah, I mean, this thing of sort of quarantining and everything, I mean, I've spent my life quarantining.
Yeah.
You see here, you know, I mean, I'm up here on my own most of the time, and I'm drawing, and if I'm not, I'm down in the workshop downstairs. But I'm on my own doing it until I get a big project. Then normally I would bring people in, or I would go out, and the gallery would become the project space, and they would bring people in, or I'd bring my, let's say, team in, and then the team would get going on something.
Well, having your studio in an industrial area like this is ideal, because you're an industrial scale...
Yeah,
artist, you know?
And I tell you what, the amount of wastage in these kind of big trading estates, you know, the number of, you know, when you think, oh, I want a bit of wood, I've got to make a pallet to ship something.
Yeah.
Well, you see pallets being chucked away, you see good bits of wood, you see sheet material, all going into these big grundens or skips. Yeah. And I go over and I say, listen, I've got to make a crate, I've got to ship something.
Here's
a couple of quid. Now, what they're doing here now is they're leaving stuff out for me.
Nice.
And it's great because I give them a couple of bob or a bottle of wine or something. Yeah. I say, that's great. Yeah, I've got two pieces of work, I've got to go north or south, and I'll go down and make my own crates or bring someone in to help me. And then, but it's all done with just a view to sort of recycling in a way, which is good.
Ideal. When was it you realised you wanted to be an artist?
That's a good question. When did I want to be an artist? I think it was probably at the time I was down in Cornwall, when I was working in the cafe, when I was doing the surfboard repairs, the fiberglassing and everything else, and buzzing around on my motorbike. I just began thinking, I think I'd better go to art school. I hadn't finished school properly, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone else had stayed on to do the A-levels and go on to university. Yeah, and I was thinking, what am I going to do in my life? I can't hang around down here for too long. You know, it's not good for my health. You know, the old early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. So I thought, I'll go back to London, and I'll, because of all the intrigue of all the lettering and the decal work for the fiberglassing of the boards, I thought I'd do the graphic design. And it was only at that point of thinking of being a graphic designer. Whilst I was there, I'd made the flip, as I explained. You know, I felt I wasn't using my hands. I was getting more intrigued with sculpture. I was around with other people who were like-minded, who were saying, oh, let's go and make something. You know, we don't want to do this stuff with lecturers, say it's a bit boring. So I'd go to the other studio with them, and we'd be hanging out, and we'd be playing with all sorts of material. And you know, I watched someone weld, and I said, I want to do that.
Yeah.
I want to be a welder. I want to stick metal together.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, you think, I could put a chair on a lamppost, or I could do that. I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could go crazy with a welder if you wanted.
Yeah.
And that was the birth of it. That was really it. There must have been something subconsciously there because of my upbringing, obviously. You know, I mean, I got dragged to galleries when I was young and stuff like that, but there weren't that many of them. But I became more and more intrigued. And then, of course, when you become intrigued, you start looking at other artists. You start a library. You know, I was getting books. I was going to private views. And then the big thing was, I was thinking, I'll go to Hornsey College of Art. I did apply elsewhere. Didn't get in. But my second choice was Hornsey. And I got in there for sculpture. They liked what I was doing on foundation. And there were a couple of guys there. In fact, the head of sculpture at the time, Nibs Dowood, Hubert Dowood, well-known sculptor, contacted myself and a colleague of mine in the first year at Hornsey and said, listen, you know, I've been watching what you're doing. You're good with your hands. Do you want to come to the studio at weekends? I'll pay you. And, of course, I got into that lifestyle of going over there and building Hubert Dowood stuff. Yeah. And then going off to the private views and looking at gorgeous girls and drinking wine. I mean, it was amazing, you know. I'd landed on my feet.
You used to cider in Cornwall.
Yeah.
Well, that's the same feeling you got there as when you invited us to work with you.
Yeah,
you know? It was quite a big deal to be a part of it, you know. I mean, you've created some massive pieces, but one of the questions I've got here that I ask every artist is, what's the artwork you've created that's got the strongest emotional connection?
Well, it's an interesting question because I've got a couple of big party pieces, and I think through just the sheer daring, structural daring of them. I mean, my most famous party piece is 2050, and it sounds very odd. It's a room filled with used waste oil.
Yeah.
Now, your listeners will be wondering, well, what's so special about that? Well, the first thing is what you thought you'd never do in your life is look at oil.
Yeah.
You know, why would you want to look at oil? What is oil? You know, well, this is used waste oil, and when I say used, it's been through the engines of cars. The graphite's been burnt, and so it's gone black. So it has this reflective power. Now that piece has been all over the world, and for most people, that is the work of the century as a sculpture. It's an anomaly. You know, how do you make it? You know, how do you store it? This, that, and the other. But for me, that's second best, that piece. My best piece I think I've ever done that's got the most emotional connection is a piece of work called Turning the Place Over.
Brilliant.
Now, Turning the Place Over was made for the European Capital of Culture in Liverpool. It still exists, but it's not switched on. It's been turned off, but it stays in a disused, derelict building that was due for demolition. Turning the Place Over comprises of cutting a circular section of the facade of a building and spinning it as fast as you can before bits fly off. So this is a 10-metre diameter section of the facade of a building in Moorfields, up in Liverpool, in the city centre, which I'd actually conceived of 10 years earlier when a model which I'd made broke and I had to repair it. And so I took the facade, which is actually something that just oscillated backwards and forwards in a previous piece called Over Easy, which is in Stockton. And it comprises of a perfect circular section that goes 300 degrees one way and 300 degrees back in the facade flat. Doesn't sort of work three-dimensionally. It's a flat turning. Well, when that spindle broke on that model, I put it down, I put the facade down on the table and stuck the spindle on it vertically upright overnight. When I came in the morning, it had fallen over about 50 degrees. And I thought, oh, God, I'll have to break that off and redo it and prop it up so it sticks on perpendicular and repairs properly. Anyway, when I picked it up and just twisted it in my thumb and my forefinger, I was turning. I thought, bloody hell. It's wobbling like a penny when you spin it or a plate when you spin it on the table. And it does that three-dimensional wobble. And I put it into a piece of card and spun it. I thought that would go right round, come out into the street, go back into the building and park itself up neatly every one revolution.
Yeah.
And so I worked on many, many models and many drawings over 10 years. I found money to do it, but conditions weren't right. Like, you know, it had to be done in London. I couldn't find a building. Then I found buildings, but the money wasn't there. Yeah. And nothing connected properly. And then I heard about the European Capital of Culture up in Liverpool. And the director of the Liverpool Biennale at that time, Lewis Biggs, I met him. There was a social going on at the Tate. And I met him in a bar before the private view on the corner of Tate Britain. And I sat down on a bar stool with him. I said, Lewis, I've got this idea. You know, it's been niggling me for 10 years. I know it's going to sound silly explaining to you, but I sat there, you know, it's almost like a drunken conversation. This building's wobbling. And I could see him listening and like trying to get an idea for it, and I couldn't draw it properly. And he said, give me a week. I'll have a think about it. Give me a week. Anyway, the next morning, I had a phone call from him. It didn't take him a week. He said, can you come up and have a look at some buildings? And I thought, I've sold it to him. So I made a couple of models, and I went up there with the models. So we sat down. I said, look, this is it. You know, all my conversation. And he completely got it. You know, he'd got it anyway. He completely got it. And he said, look, there's these buildings. There's about five of them. And we went round and we looked at the Moorfields one, all due for demolition, these buildings. Yeah, yeah. So we were allowed to intervene. We were allowed to tamper with the structure. And I said, this is the building. It's got the right stonework. We can work with that. Bricks would be too fragile. The building will fall apart, you know. And it's got a lot of steel in there. It was an early 60s building. And it was a Yates's wine lodge on the ground floor. It had been. And then four or five floors of insurance upstairs. But it was all derelict, smashed up. The Yates's wine lodge was flooded. You know, the roof was leaking. So we knew we could take this building, the written off, the forlorn, the forgotten, the eyesore, and we could transform it, and we did. And we had everyone from all over the world coming to view that piece of work, and almost every architectural magazine in the world covered it. And I still get people writing to me today saying, when are you switching it back on?
Yeah.
And there's moments where we've nearly got there. There's been a big campaign very recently to have it switched back on because of its something like 10th or 20th anniversary.
If
you know.
It was due for demolition, how comes it's still there?
What it is the site is controversial. It's due for demolition. It's in the centre of, I say the centre, it's up towards the docks, up towards Tate, Liverpool.
Yeah.
It sits surrounded by a very old derelict car park. But for anyone to buy that building and want to pull it down and put up a tower block in the centre of Liverpool is impossible. The pile work is very near to the confluence, the meeting of three tunnels under Liverpool. You know, the Mersey, and there's two others, and I don't know what they are. So for anyone to put in a proposal for like a 10, 20-storey job, you'd never get it.
They've got so much work
to do with how the pile work would go down into Liverpool's bedrock without disturbing the tunnels. That would take years and years and years. So it's not really worth anyone doing anything. It is owned by a company at the moment, but they bought it off another company who bought it off another company because the council sold it. So the building is there. All the gubbins and the piece of work is there, but no one wants to turn it back on. Because if you do, you carry the warranty for it. I don't. You know, just like your building, if a pane of glass fell out and hit someone on the head, you'd be... So no one wants to switch it back on. And yet, if they did, you know, as a tourist attraction, it was just...
I like that story you told us about the cab driver.
Oh, yeah. That was a funny one. That was when, in 2008, that was the European Capital of Culture, the Tate decided to do the Turner Prize up at Tate Liverpool because of it, you know, being the European capital. And I thought, I had an invite to go up, and I thought, I'll go up to Liverpool only because I can PR my work. I could go around and say, go and have a look at this. You know, it's turning heads. It's called turning the place over. Everyone's talking about it. But, of course, I didn't need to because everyone was looking at it. It had been on news at 10 and everything. So I went up there and the train was held up. So I was really late to get to this thing. So I ran out the station, jumped into a cab. And I said to the cab driver, take Liverpool as fast as you can. And he went, oh, that bloody place. And he said... Bloody art. He was driving and moaning. Bloody art. You know, we've got bloody art everywhere here. It's bloody waste of time, waste of money. You know, the usual arguments. Yeah. You could buy a kidney dialysis machine. You could do this, do that. And he said, are you an artist? I said, yeah, I'm a sculptor. He said, have you got a bit of time? I'm going to take you to see a real bit of sculpture. And he drove me to my work.
Excellent.
And I didn't know what to do. And I was sitting in the car and said, that's bloody brilliant. I didn't want to tell him it was me because he'd think he'd have a nutter in the back of the car and make me walk to the Tate, you know, so get out, you know, and he'd dash away. So I was sitting in the back of the car and he jumped out of the car and he ran around. He parked up in the middle of the road and said, you can't sit in the car, you've got to stand here.
Excellent.
And he took me to a bit of the road and he said, watch what happens here. It's not circular, it's an ovoid. How does he do it? And it is, because if you cut into a building at 50 degrees, it's a bit like... It's a bit like taking a plastic soil pipe and not cutting it straight across, but cutting it at an angle. Yeah. When you look at it, it's an ovoid, but then as you turn the pipe, it's actually circular, because it is a circular pipe, exactly. You know. So there's a conundrum, a shape conundrum going on. And he took me to this one point in the street he'd found where he could see it's a perfect ovoid. And he said, I don't know how he's done it, it's an ovoid, but it goes back on itself. It must sort of move. It. And I was saying, it's bloody brilliant. And I said, but it's getting a bit late, we've got to go, mate.
I mean, that little story means more to me than if an artist was telling you how great it was. You know, for someone who had not only no interest in art, but, you know, had a negative view on it.
Well, the Liverpudlians up there were terrific. You know, I mean, there were people who were anti it, first of all, saying, you know, what a waste of time. And I had to point out to them, listen, mate, this is central government money paid by Blair for a capital of culture in Liverpool, where that money goes northwest and is given to local people to build that.
Yeah.
And he could see it then. But one guy was really good, because there was a lot of people just rocking up to look at the piece, you know, at the private view. It was at guests, but it was also anybody in the city, and everyone had heard about it. And this old boy came up to me and he said, see what you've done there, you know, in a Liverpudlian accent. See what you've done there,
from
mate.
From Birmingham, was he?
Yeah. see what you've done there, mate. When people staggered out of that Yates's Wine Lodge, the building was doing it then.
Yeah, you're doing nothing new. You're just making them see it. So
and I could see, you know, the old Aussie Whites was going down. You come out that building, the building's spinning all over the place.
Was it in Liverpool where you drilled through the gallery down?
No, but that is an interesting proposal that never ever got built. And in a funny way, Gary, there are certain pieces of work that I dream up which somehow are probably better not made. And the example of that one...
Getting mixed up with Matt's gallery. Water table.
Yeah, but what I was going to say about the drilling down, I did have an idea. I did have a very interesting idea for Tate Liverpool, which never got made, and in a way really only exists as a story or a set of drawings and writing. And what that was I was invited up to Liverpool ages ago, outside the Liver building, myself and four other artists from around the world, actually, five of us, to look at an old bus depot site where the buses turned around and went back into the city. And they wanted some kind of sculptural bridge or something. And while I was up there, we had a lunch with the local councillors in the Liver building. And I was thinking, oh God, it's a bit windswept up here. I can't come up with any ideas. This is a bit boring. So I'm having a sandwich and this old boy comes up, one of the councillors, and he's saying, you know, Liverpool's full of history, the docks are beautiful and this, that and the other. But then he said something that floored me completely. He said, you know, the docks go up and down an inch, about an inch and a half every tide. I said, what are you drinking? He said, no, the docks are all built on greenwood piles. And when the tide comes in, they sweat, he said. Yeah. They sweat. And I said, what's that? He said, it's like a sponge. They take a bit of water and they grow.
Expand, yeah.
And all that stone rises and falls about an inch every tide. Now, I don't know if that's true, but the way he told it to me...
Feasible, though, isn't it?
..made me sit on the train. I'd got the idea already. It just came like that. You know, I mistrust ideas. If I get an idea, I need to take it for a walk round the block for a couple of months and really test it to make sure I've got it right. But what I thought was, if you drilled from the top floor of Tate Liverpool right down through all the floors and down into the basement and down into Liverpool bedrock, and you then fixed a bronze rod that was probably about 2 or 3 inches in diameter from the top floor down into Liverpool bedrock, you'd walk in there and you'd trip over this thing on the floor that's an inch sticking up out the floor. You'd trip over and you go, what the bloody hell's that doing there? If you came back 6 hours later and said to someone, look what I tripped over, it'd be flush with the floor. Because the whole building, the whole of Liverpool Tate has gone up and made that flush. And then when it goes down and stops sweating on the tide, that inch and a half of bronze will be sticking out. Conceptually, it's a massive, massive leap.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful idea. To do it, You're running the risk of, does it actually move? You know, is it going to move that amount each time?
Did you ever find out if it was true or not?
I never found out if it was true, but I did a series of drawings. I sold them all. Did a series of drawings just about that.
I remember you saying about it.
And it became a talking piece.
It's got mixed up in my mind that it was an actual artwork.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was a piece of work that really did exist as a concept. It exists as drawings. But it's one that never got built, and I don't think it ever will. I think sometimes you do need to have pieces that are so good, but you don't. They can't get built. And people do mention it every now and again when they write about me. But you mentioned water table. Yes, I made a piece of work. We're now talking about 2000 and was it 2002? I've forgotten when this was, actually. 1994. The new Matt's Gallery. And I had this idea. I mean, no one had seen the new space. I had the first show, as it were, in one of the spaces. I think Willie Doherty was before me. It was two spaces. He'd got that space, but no one had seen the new space. And I thought I'd make a piece of work that sits outside the rented area. You know, it could be outside the window or up above the ceiling or down in the ground. So that when you went in, you just saw the rented space, as it were, the gallery space, but the sculpture was also occupying it, but outside of it, if you understand what I'm saying. So I came up with this idea. What we would do is I would buy a shed structure. I was thinking about a cricket pavilion, you know, and we'd dig all the floor up because it was a wreck anyway, so we could do it. And put it in there upside down. So it's a bit like referring to the oil. You could see the world upside down because it's a reflection. Yeah. But in fact, it's like you're looking down at the inside of the ceiling as opposed to looking up at the ceiling, you know, that sort of thing. Anyway, I started thinking about it. And to sort of test the idea, I brought in an engineer and we dug a hole.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hole. A 4-foot hole just to check what was down there. And we got down to 4 feet and it started filling with water, a bit like being on the beach, you know, like plop and it's falling in. He said, what we've got here, Richard, the engineer, Robert Myers from Price and Myers Structural Engineers, he's retired now. Lovely man. And he said, we've got a problem here. We've got liquid sand. And I said, what's that, Robert? And he said, it's when you dig a hole, you've got basically London's groundwater down there and it's pulling the material from out around the sides of the hole into it, which means you're probably bringing these columns in. You can either throw a lot of money at it and coffer dam the whole thing, or you can put a pump on it, or you can forget your idea and change your idea. And I thought, I've got to change the idea. Yeah. Got 19 days to change my idea. And I thought, the water is the problem, but that's got to be what the piece is about now.
Yeah.
I've got to use the problem to get around the problem. It's got to inform me. I'd already understood what the history of the building was, and it was, I don't know if it was called Lloyd's, but it was a building that at one point in its history had built billiard tables there, you know, and it was famous for it. And I came up with this idea because I was looking out the window thinking, I'm in trouble here. I've got 19 days. I've got to do something. And I saw these big gas holders. And of course, you know, it's a bit like the piece I described in Liverpool. You know, 1 minute the structure's there and the next minute it's all below ground. And I thought these things are, you know, they're going up and down. They're in and out. What, can't I just put something that sort of frames the water in some way? I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll get a billiard table. This is what they built them in this room. I'll get a billiard table and I'll set it into the floor. But what it will do is it will acquire a seventh pocket in the form of a Hepworth 28-inch sewer pipe, concrete sewer pipe. So I dug down and we set First of all, we set the table. We dug a pit with the, you know, so the table went down with the legs and everything, cemented it round, left it a bit rough at the edges. So you had the six pockets and you had the lovely cushion all round. And then I cut the table very carefully and neatly so that part the cushion went and part the table went. And we inserted two sections of pipe that went down 4 metres and contained the water down there. So it wouldn't allow any of the falling in. Then I submerged into that water a paddle, a waterproof paddle system. And so when you went into the room, what you saw was the room. And then you noticed something on the floor, flush with the floor, and you went over to it. And you kind of took that cushion shot pose, where you're sort of over the cushion, looking down into that murky subconscious world of the 28-foot Hepworth pipe with this dark water down there. And every now and again, there'd be a splash. Yeah. Like there's a frog, a fish, something horrible. Yeah. Something scary. Would if I fell down, I'd get myself wedged. Yeah. So it had all of those connotations from the real logic of the game and the the perfectness of the level and the precision to this other subconscious thing of, like, you know, London's groundwater, what's below there. And so that pipe's still in there, by the way. When that all came out, we didn't pull the pipes out. Just cemented it in, so it's down there still.
Of course. Well, wouldn't you? What do you do to relax, Richard?
What do I do to relax? I do two things quite regularly. I play drums, as you can see.
Yeah, I didn't notice.
I unwind. It keeps me fit. I play a lot with a lot of other people. I don't play conventionally. I do a lot of improvisation. So, like the steam whistles I blow, of my friends, these are all voices. They each have a voice, and I just put piles of drums together and I play those. The other thing I do is I've got a very dear friend called Jock McFadden, a painter, and for about 25-30 years now we've been doing off-road motorcycling. So I've got off-road motorbikes in France, where I've got a place, and I've got an off-road bike downstairs, and I'm going this Saturday to Kent. I do the Pilgrim's Way, I go off north and places. So I ride. I mean, I'm getting a bit old now for it. I'm 67, but I still get on the bike, and when you open that bike up, it's a dream. And you're in the wilderness. I mean, there is this thing about cleaning the planet. You know, I'm riding two-stroke stuff, and I did have four-stroke, all got stolen. But the two-stroke stuff I've still got. I've got a Fantic, I've got a Kawasaki 200, I've got a DT175. So I've got three off-road bikes, which I can choose. And I did have a TTR 250, but that's just gone. But I can get off into the wilderness and just ride, and it's so beautiful. Yeah. It's so open, and the, you know, being in the French forest and riding hundreds of miles, you know, you've got every terrain. You've got hills, you've got rivers, you've got flat sections, fast sections, you've got real slow, you know, where you've got to pick yourself over stuff. I'm not brilliant at it, and I'm too old to be doing it, but that I enjoy. And as I say, drums. Other than that, I'm getting into cooking as well now. I'm beginning to enjoy. But I get very fixed on things. Like, I've really just got into my jams because I've never done it before. But we've had a good crop this year in France, which I brought back. So I've just been trying to hunt down pectin in London, which is difficult. And the Kilner jar rubbers, they're difficult to get hold of. You can get it all online, but when you want to be immediate about things. And I've got my daughter's a very good cook, and she's got me caught up in making ice cream. So I'm making kulfi at the moment with, you know, with the cardamom seeds and rose water, bit of cinnamon, bit of nutmeg, and all the other little ingredients, my secret ingredients that go in to make a nice Indian ice cream.
Nice. Can't get much better than that. If there was a five artists, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Of five artists?
Yeah. Oh, and yourself.
Myself, or me, and four others. I think I'd have to think of a contemporary grouping to make sense of my work with them. I mean, I wouldn't say Michelangelo because I don't think it would fit.
Yeah.
Although I do like the Rondanini and the very, very, very last works where he obviously changed his mind halfway through, and so he left part of the sculpture as the previous. So there'd be an arm. It's very surreal. There'd be an arm in amongst the Pieta or something like that. Yeah, yeah. An arm that wasn't part of the couple, the Christ and the Madonna. I would say when I was at college, I was fascinated by the very early works of Barry Flanagan. What I liked about Barry is you never knew what he was going to do next.
Nice.
Whereas with some artists, you know exactly what they're going to do. You know they're not going to change. It's probably driven by finance. Why would they want to change? But with Barry, there was no market at that time. When he started doing the hairs, that's an example of somebody who got stuck with money.
Yeah.
And that's what all he did. And he made a lot of money and he lived happily ever after. He didn't live very long after that, but he lived happily while he had life. So Barry Flanagan, some of those early works, and particularly the more crazy ones, like he made a film where he just got a load of stools and paper and then he had a bag of sand and he stabbed it. And the sand and the bag was swinging, he kept pushing it and he was filming it and then it collapsed the whole structure under it. Or another very beautiful piece he made called Hole in the Sea. So it exists as a film and a set of photographs where he wades into the water in off the Dutch coastline. And he just got a plexiglass cylinder. It's about a foot and a half. And he pushes it in the sand and holds it there while the tide comes in and goes round it.
Yeah.
And then it begins to flood. So he picks it up and then he does it again where it's a dry patch. When you think about that country and it being below sea level, and him doing that piece as land art as a kind of a metaphor for what the country is suffering at that time, you know, about having to dam its coast.
Yeah.
So I'd say Barry Flanagan. I'd probably take someone who became an influence very later on in my life, although I never heard about him when I was doing what I was doing, but Gordon Matta-Clark, an American artist who trained as an architect, but very interesting sculptor who cut buildings. We did them for very different... He did them for very different reasons to me, but he was an interesting artist and very visual, very stunning pieces. God, that's three of us. I need another two, didn't I? Someone contemporary. I don't know. Probably White Reed or Mike Nelson. Rachel White Reed, Mike Nelson. Yeah. I'd use them. I know them both personally. Funny enough, I've had occasion to teach both of them in my past, and that's all good stuff, and that would sit comfortably with Barry and myself and Gordon Matta-Clark. I'm trying to think of someone who's outside of the sculptural area, someone who's slightly quirky, someone who's a bit offbeat, someone who exists in the cracks. I suppose I have to say my friend Anne Bean, a very, very interesting performance artist, done a lot of collaboration with many, many different artists and people, and people who didn't think they were artists, where she's drawn them in and worked with them, different genders, that sort of thing. You know, she's unpredictable, and that's what I like about my life. I like unpredictability because that trains you to get smart, get tough, and get clever. You can get very complacent and you take things for granted and then things can catch you out and pull you apart.
Yeah.
You have to be on your toes all the time. And artists particularly have to be on their toes to sort of be relevant, really.
You mentioned about, at the start there, you mentioned about Barry Flanagan and the materials that he was using. I'm about to talk about myself here, and I'm not putting myself in his category by any means. But when I was in prison and making art, I wasn't allowed materials. You know, obviously there was a shitload of materials I couldn't even go near, you know, let alone use. So I'd be using stuff around me, like scrap that was around me.
Yeah.
And the trouble I had when I come out of jail and then. Pretty much the next day, I was at university.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guys at university, the tutors, they were going, right, you can use whatever you want. You can do building, you can do sculpture, you can do printing. I just wanted to use fag butts. And my mind weren't in a place where I could look at anything and use anything. Mine was just, it was so narrow.
But also very inventive. Very inventive. I mean, a friend of mine is a musician. I haven't seen him for a long while, Max Easterly. And he told me a very interesting story about how he did a week's course in a prison about making sound. And he was stunned at what notes people could get out of a Rizzler paper or just the kind of sounds that were sent down corridors just by tapping.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because people in that situation, in that confined situation, had to find a way to communicate, tapping pipes or whatever,
yeah.
or blowing notes on a Rizla,
yeah.
to get that to happen. And it blew him away. He said, you know, they were better than he was in terms of being inventive and imaginative,
yeah.
and finding, seeking a way around the problem of communication.
Yeah.
It's that thing, you know. If you know, what is invention? You could say, well, okay, if I put a tin of evaporated milk down there and said, yeah, that's yours, but I wouldn't give you an opener. How would you get the tin off? You know, how'd you get the lid off?
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing. You'd have to start looking around, wouldn't you? I've got a pencil. I've got a bent screw here. If I could just get a hole in it, I could maybe use
a lot of bent screws. In there.
But it's that sort of thing, you know. I think what I like about art and sculpture is, you know, like, give yourself a problem to solve. Give yourself something. It's almost like saying, what interests me is what I can't do.
Yeah.
And if I get it and I can then do it, then I've gained, I've learnt, I've gone forward.
Yeah.
And if I've excited myself first, then I know I'm possible to excite other people.
Well, in life, most of our problems are solved
yeah.
for us, aren't
yeah.
they? If you wasn't an artist, what would you like to be?
Oh, what would I like to be? I don't know. I mean, I'd have to go way, way back. There were two little dreams. I always fancied the MotoGP.
Oh, of course.
You know, the dream. But I was never someone. You know, there are those people, when they get on a machine, there's something that kicks in that takes them beyond safety. They go at a speed where I could never go. So that was out the window. Funny enough, the other thing, which I kind of am intrigued by, and I thought I could do very well, and it's about material, and it's about sort of not playing with material, it's about fixing and repairing. I've always fancied the idea that perhaps I could have been a surgeon. You know, I'm not squeamish.
Yeah.
I've always thought that it's a very... I'm intrigued, like, how do you stitch together veins, or how do you put a muscle back together with cotton, or is it with a laser light where you and I think I could have done it really well. What I couldn't have done is the academia that goes with it.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done the Latin, I couldn't have done all the naming and stuff, but to take, you know, the human material and repair it as a surgeon,
yeah.
fascinates me. You know, and I think it would be more the physical side of things. It'd be muscle and bone. It wouldn't be nerve endings
yeah,
and
yeah.
brain and that sort of thing. I'd specialise in the, what is it, the osteopathic end of it all. Fixing bones, you know, putting brackets in to knit things together.
It's all associated with the work that you do anyway.
Yeah, you're in there with a Black and Decker and a hacksaw.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not much different. So those were the two crazy ends of the spectrum, which came in after I was an artist. I mean, I just used to think about it, you know, like that question, and what would you do if you weren't doing this? And I thought, yeah, I could do that. I reckon I could do that. If I, you know, found myself in that situation, I wouldn't be afraid to get a needle out and sew someone up.
Yeah.
If I was, you know, on a desert island and there'd been a plane crash, I'd run over and... But other than that, I don't know now. I mean, now it's really too late to think about it. It's interesting watching my kids growing up. You know, they're in their 20s, late 20s, and, you know, they're in odd professions, which I could never dream of doing. I would never want to have been in a band. My son is. I wouldn't want to be a trapeze artist. My daughter is. They're like art. They're too difficult. There's no money.
Yeah.
Unless you make it really big. You know, if he sells a song to Adele, he's made it, but that won't happen.
Yeah.
I don't think.
I couldn't name a famous trapeze artist.
No,
I'm sure there are a few.
But in a funny way, it's difficult to explain this. In a funny way, being a sculptor, I've done a lot of other things. You know, I mean, I've built the house I own.
Yeah.
Not from the bricks up, but I know how to... I could put a structure together and live in it. I've mended vehicles, cars and bikes that I've
yeah.
owned, because I can weld and I know a little bit about mechanics and stuff. So I've been a mechanic through
yeah.
sculpture. You know, turning the place over. Not that I designed the mechanical aspect of that sculpture, but I was certainly there with my Meccano set, talking to the engineers when I first got the idea with worm screws and everything else, looking at Leonardo da Vinci's rack and pinion concept, yeah. and the engineer saying, you know, that would be such a trustworthy thing to use. It's a bit clunky, but that would be better than what we've designed. Brilliant. So, you know, things like that. My career as a sculptor has taken me into the world of other professions. Just, you know, just sort of coming up with an idea and then having to go and buy material means, you know, you've got that quality to go, you know, to be a like quantity surveyor maybe, yeah, even, yeah. you know, evaluating what is necessary to make that work. What's the best and what's the cheapest? What's going to last longest? Should I duck and dive on the price or should I look at what's going to last and be value for money? You know, so all that kind of thinking as well comes into play. So there's lots of skills that sculptors have which aren't just about aesthetic form being put together, you know.
And especially yours, where it's quite industrial all the time.
Yeah.
You mentioned about building your house just now. And when we was unbuilding the plane, pulling the plane apart, you was telling Lee and I about an artwork which has fascinated me, setting off for Japan. When you was telling us about how that idea come about, that was was something else.
Shall I tell you that again? Well, set north for Japan was an invitation to go out to, first of all, to Tokyo, and then from there take the bullet train out to the Niigata prefecture, which is on the west coast of Japan, and to meet there with my dear friend Fram Kitagawa, who runs the Art Front Gallery. And he was responsible for a big 10-year program that was taking place in that region. The region was dying, and Fram Kitagawa put forward this idea that it could be saved through maybe artists going in industry, going into the creative industries as well, like schools, etc., going into the workplace, and also putting sculpture there for a tourist attraction industry. So I went out there, and I hadn't really done any outdoor work, and I went to this mountainous area and was shown a site at the back of a junior school, which is a big flat area, with next to it a great big temple gateway, verticals and horizontals, and I had to think of something to go on this site that would attract people. And the one thing that the one criteria that they were insistent upon was that whatever you did, it had to have a relationship to you and the region. Somehow there had to be a connection between what you do, who you are, and the region itself. I didn't know what I was doing. I got back on that aeroplane. I thought, this is something I'm gonna have to write and say I can't do it anyway. It's a long flight. It's 12 and a half hours going back to Heathrow. The dawn came up and I could see the curvature of the earth. And it's an absolutely mind-blowing experience being, you know, 5 miles up in a jumbo in first class. I was sent back in first class, which is very nice. And I'm sitting there and the porthole's in front of you in first class because I was seat number two. So as you're in the cone, you know, the porthole's come round. So you're facing forward and looking out rather than turning sideways.
That's something you don't normally get, isn't it?
And I was looking at the curvature of the earth, and bing, the light bulb idea went on. You know, I play with architecture. I thought, I'm going to build my house in the Niigata prefecture at the junior high school area, right next to the verticals and horizontals of the temple gateway. But it's going to be at the angle it stands in Rotherhithe, SE16. What I'd do is I'd go and see the engineers, I'd make a model. Rather than build the whole house, I made a linear description of the house. Yeah. I made an idea that could be made in I-beams. And it was full scale. And I took it and I said to the engineers, I want this house not to stand on its base, but I want it to stand on its base as it does in Rotherhithe, but in Japan, if you see what I mean. Almost like pushing it through the... Yeah. What happens if you just pushed it straight through the earth? So it'd be virtually upside down and crooked. Yeah. Anyway, what they said is they needed to calculate 5 angles of collimation. And what they are, they're 5 points in the ground off the North Star from Rotherhithe, and then transfer those around the world to the engineers around the world to do. So what happened is they built the house, got the sponsorship from the Maeda Foundation. They built the steel structure. They made the structure in component parts. They then brought it to the site and built it. And they then got 2 cranes and they turned it upside down and set it on the 4 points of 5 The fifth one is just so to make sure the other four are right. You know, you do it four times, but you'll do a fifth one just to make double dot the situation. And so the house is out there still today, but it's upside down on its part of its roof because that's the exact angle it stands. And it's talking about the distance between that point in Niigata Prefecture and that point in Rotherhithe. They're identical. Beautiful. The house is the same. The house is the same. Beautiful. But you know, the Japanese are very beautiful people and they have lovely stories. And I heard one the other week. A friend of mine, Rika, came out to my little place out in France, and she's one of the singers with the Frank Chicken Band. And she was talking about lovely stories about the Japanese and their invention and miniaturization. And she told me a story about space, which I found really fascinating. Every time I meet someone, I tell them. And the Japanese are into miniaturization. They can miniaturize things really well. And there was this, she was telling me about this one phone company that wanted to get their phone smaller, and they thought they'd done it. And they gave it to the director. All these engineers had been working on this little phone. And he took it and he was looking at it. And next to him, he had a glass vessel of water. And he said, yeah, it looks really good. It really is small in the hand. And he put it in the water and a couple of bubbles came out. And he said, but it's not small enough. There's still space in there.
If the air's come out, wow.
That's the Japanese for you.
Brilliant.
That's how they do it. It's all empirical thinking. It's like they've got all the computers and everything else, but that man just put it in water and said, there's air in there. Get rid of the air and it'll make it smaller.
How much does that bubble take?
And that is an idea, you see. That's what gets me going. I think that's so beautiful. Someone else told me a story like that as well. And it's an example about space. What is space? And it's about a guy who moves into a trading estate, rather like this, and next door to him some people are moving in, and they've got a skip. And one evening he's gone outside and he said to the bloke who was filling the skip, he said, listen, I've only got a little bit in here, can I pay you to put some of my rubbish in your skip? And the bloke said, that's all right, you know, I'll have a word with the boss in the morning, he'll be in. But that's okay. He had a look at what he had. He said, you've hardly got anything, you can put it in, it's okay, he won't charge you. So the next morning, the guy gets in early. He's got his little pile of stuff, and he's just putting it in. The car pulls up, and it's the boss. And the boss says, what do you think you're doing? He said, listen, I've had a word with your friend, and I've shown him what it is, and I'm willing to pay. But he said, it's all right. It's so small, you can put it in. And the boss said, well, that's okay then if you've agreed it. Otherwise, I would have done you with the police for stealing. And he said, but hang on a minute. I'm not taking anything out of your skip. I'm dumping mine. He said, exactly. You're stealing my space. I've paid for that space, and you're taking it away by putting your stuff in. I would have done you for stealing if you hadn't had the permission. The idea of stealing space is a lot, and I use it as a title for a show, Stealing Space.
It's great when things come along like that, isn't it? When you talk about being a surgeon, you mentioned about the academia.
Yeah.
How did becoming an RA come about?
It's interesting. Royal Academician. You can't nominate yourself and you can't apply for it. What it is the Royal Academicians, numbering in their 70s, I think, about 74, 75 as currently. They're a membership group of the Royal Academy that goes way, way back, and they meet probably about three times a year for what's called the General Assembly. And in that General Assembly, there'll be a vote taken based on nominations given by the membership of artists they think are relevant to today, let's say, and have done, let's say, distinguished in their field, whatever that happens to be, painting, sculpture, printmaking, you know, film, whatever. And in, God, when was it? 2006, I had a phone call from Bill Woodrow, who was a member, who phoned me up out of the blue one afternoon and said, congratulations, Richard, you're a Royal Academician. And I said, what's that? What have I got to do? And he said, well, come on in. You know, we'll introduce you to everybody. So myself and Chris Wilkinson on that particular General Assembly had been put forward as nominations. A whole group of people had put forward as nomination. It goes to a shortlist. And then there's a vote in the room. So you know you've been voted in by your fellow.
Are you there when that vote was taken?
No. You get a phone call after and say, you know, well done, you're a Royal Academician. Do you want to be one or not? Some people say, no, I want nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Other people say, yeah, that's fantastic. And I said, yes, that's fantastic. And people have asked me, why do you want to be? And I suppose what it is I'm sort of probably seen to be at more the esoteric end of the art world, in that, you know, you've got painting and you've got sculpture and you've got printmaking, you've got architecture. What I do is, you know, I've dabbled in sound making as art, and I've dabbled in performance as art, and I make very big installations, site-specific installations as art. So they're all slightly quirky, zany, you know, or seen as, you know, installation, what's that? What's site-specificity? What's that? Yeah. You know, it's not sculpture made in a studio. It was something that was relevant to its location when you look at it, that sort of thing. So I thought to be a Royal Academician gave me a little bit of kudos, as opposed to being the wacky, zany person. You know, the one, you know, he's the weirdo who's at that end of the spectrum of sculpture. I wanted to be sort of at the forefront, and I wanted to be recognised as, you know, as being as relevant as those guys and girls there who are sculptors, yeah. You know, rather than being the weirdo one. So, yeah, being a Royal Academician did that. Also, it's a pretty good door opener, especially abroad, because I mean, it's the only time I've ever done it. I never did it with my MFA or BA or whatever, but I always put Richard Wilson RA, and I kind of quite like
of
that.
And why not?
I don't do it all the time, but I use it.
I've been on pizza order.
Yeah, no, I've used it when I've gone to meet counsellors or sponsors or engineers or whatever. I put RA. Gives you a little bit of clout.
Yeah.
They're not just talking to anybody. They're talking to Richard Wilson RA. And it's useful. Let's just say that. It's useful. If you've got it, flaunt it. I think it's important. It's an honour to be asked onto these things.
Yeah.
And it's important to, you know, do your best with them and make that commitment. But it's also great that you've got... But, you know, it's another lever to help you, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, I didn't know how a professorship works, and that's pretty much a similar sort of ways, isn't it?
Never really bothered with it. I mean, I've been a professor, and I've been honorary professor, but, you know, I've never really written that down. I might have used it perhaps once or twice in a CV, depending on who I'm writing to.
Yeah.
But the Royal Academician one, I certainly do, and it's... I think it's because it is in the popular psyche. People do know about it, you know, the public psyche, I should say. People do know about the Royal Academy and the academicians.
Mm.
They see them as old fogies, but then again, they're not. You know, there's a lot of new blood in there now, and it's really sort of in the present tense. You know, it's in the present day, and it's sort of up and coming, but still up and coming. After so many hundreds of years, you know, we've 200 odd years we've been going. And it's just you're in with a really good group of friends, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, not everyone you'd hang out with, of course. You know.
Well, I obviously don't keep abreast of who is. I mean, I only saw that you were when it got meant. I was reading something one time.
Yeah.
It said Richard Wilson, RA. And I was like, when did he become an? I saw it a few years ago. Yeah. But like to Gary Hume and
Tracy's one. Yeah, yeah.
And when I saw it, there was a photograph. A couple of years ago, a group of all of you there, and I was going, I didn't know that, I didn't know that. Yeah, it's good to see people there, and it's keeping an old establishment relevant. And
it's funny, you know, people do turn it down. Damien Hirst turned it down, Sarah Lucas turned it down. So now, when you get nominated, what has to happen now is you have to send out a little sort of feeler, you know, like if should I ask if Gary wants to be an RA? Gary, do you want to be an RA? If you say, yeah, I'd love to be one, then I can go back right in. That sort of thing. Yeah. You have to kind of do a little bit of sounding out.
Well, I'm still in contact with Gary and Tracy.
Yeah.
So if I have a little word with all three of you...
Yeah, yeah.
I've just got to produce some work that's slightly relevant to the world. What have you got coming up, Richard? Anything?
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, I've got the show in Istanbul.
Yeah.
That's coming up. That's a one-person show, opening in February, runs to the end of March, early April. It's a commercial show, so preparing all of that. That's drawings, that's prints, and sculptures, object sculptures, not the big stuff. We are doing 2050, however, in the space. They've got a sponsor, so they'll be putting that work in. I'm also working on the Steam Whistle Museum for the Slice of Reality, which will take the slice away from its location and put it on land, and my friend's collection hopefully will go in, and we'll make it a live whistle museum.
Nice.
Very, very odd thing to do, but I think it'll get a little bit of attention, and maybe even try and do it holding the hand of the Maritime Museum. Maybe they'd be involved as well.
Yeah.
And we'll put a little board of trustees together, made of musicians and possibly engineers, you know, and see where that goes. That's a long-term project with Zatorski and Zatorski. Then there's a lot of little bits and pieces. I'm working with Plinth on some sketches that will be done as an edition, a print edition. That's probably the... There's a lot of other little bits and pieces. You know, there's some performance stuff, some sound stuff with drums. Mm. But what I really want to do is I want to put a book together. I haven't done a book since about 2001 or 2004.
Yeah.
And I think the last one was the Richard Wilson tape book. And it's way behind on some of the really good pieces. You know, it's not got Turning the Place Over. It's not got Slipstream Down at Heathrow Airport. It's not got the piece on Holborn, on the London School of Economics building. Yeah. Some of the big, big pieces that I'm known for aren't in books that are about me. You know, they're in books about public art, or they're in books written about specifically about site-specific works.
Yeah.
So I'd like to get a big book together, you know, like a Fiden thing or a Thames and Hudson thing. I don't know whether I'm sort of feeling a little bit insecure with, you know, recognition, but those pieces need to be seen in print.
Oh, definitely.
You know what I mean? Because people sort of, I hear people saying, you know, that's a great piece of work. Who did it? And they don't know it's me, you know. So I need to put the face to the work.
You mentioned Slipstream there. When I first saw it on TV,
yeah.
I don't know if I saw the finished piece or the idea. I don't know who's on TV talking about the idea. But when I saw it, I was like, that is just fucking typical Richard Wilson to look at the space as something takes up in space.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I thought it was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And when I actually went there, it's quite breathtaking.
Yeah.
When you see it, because I didn't know I was coming up to it.
You come out that lift and it's,
it's there. And I was like, fuck, there it is. Amazing.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of, that was an interesting commission that I got, where, that was through Future City, actually. And I've worked with them once or twice before. And they were working with the architects, Grimshaws, on that specific area of the airport, and the original idea was to have planting. They were going to put trees in there, and then it was discovered that the light levels would not sustain the growth of the trees, so something else had to go there. And Mark Davey, the director of Future City, said, listen, you're arriving at the cultural capital of the world when you get off those planes at Heathrow Airport. We need something in that airport that says, yes, you have arrived at the cultural capital. It starts right here when you get off the aeroplane. So let's have a sculpture. So a long list was put together. And from that long list, Heathrow and a few other people outside of the Heathrow committee brought it down to a group of five. Two Americans, two English and one Japanese. And we were all interviewed and I got the gig. You know, they chose me, which was great. And it was a 3-year build. It was a year of bureaucracy, with a lot of fighting to actually do what I wanted to do. That's not restrictions from Heathrow. They were brilliant. They were really on it. It was more sort of an issue with Department of Trade and, you know, the security issue. Like, if a bomb goes off, this thing's going to fly everywhere.
Yeah.
What are you going to do about it? So we had to get it bomb tested. We had to build a section, take it up to an army base, and they put markers all over it and stake out a field. They blow it, and then they go and count all the pieces. And
you didn't even think that was...
It didn't even blow up. We built it so it wouldn't fly. You know, it wouldn't fly apart, which presented another problem, which basically was, OK, it's not shattered. We don't know what you've done, but it means if a hypothetical bomb did go off in Heathrow Airport, the lateral loading on the sculpture would push the columns, and they would buckle and bring the roof down. What are you going to do about that? Unfortunately, a lot of the budget went on building laterally loaded bearings. So that sculpture can move if it wants to.
Yeah.
If it gets a sudden thrust from anything, i.e. the hypothetical bomb in a transit, the whole thing just swings. And you won't see it on the structure, but it's all hidden inside. And that's what the engineers are great at doing. It wasn't part of the brief, it wasn't part of the project. But those,
there's something inside that takes the lateral loading. What is there that does that? There's something that does
there's
that.
Bridges. When you get lateral loading on wind, you know, like they did with the Millennium Bridge, they had to really think about that. And they've got it cushioned now, so it's actually all capable and able to take the movement if it's hit by gusts on the river. But I tell you where it's a classic situation like that, not so much dealing with terrorist acts, but if you go to Los Angeles, a lot of those skyscrapers are built on roller bearings.
That's what I'm thinking.
When you get a tremor in the earth, the building is sort of standing still.
There was a building in Japan, and when they got to the top, I'm getting it now, they've put a great big weight at the top of a building, I think. And when the building moves, the weight counteracts the movement, so it actually slows the building down.
Yeah.
I knew what I was going to say.
Beautiful concept. Beautiful concept. I mean, yeah. There's some lovely ideas that I've got. I mean, I just need to find venues to do them. I mean, like one here is the precursor to Slipstream.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. And it's actually a tumbling car. It's actually a tumbling car. The original idea was a car. See the car?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you put that in the computer as a virtual model, and then you throw it in space, so it's like not a car crash, because it's not got the history of a car crash, but the car is actually, you know, moving in space. And it's fine, so these would be the wheels.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be a form built in aluminium that would just be in along a boulevard, or wherever. So there's you know, there's concepts like that that are still in existence as big sculptures, where I can take objects and put them in the virtual world of the computer with a certain program, and I can actually allow them to tumble, fall, spin. What I do is I go in there and I take a hamster ball with a car glued in it, and I roll.
Sort of thing,
yeah. Well, it takes it out slightly outside of their everyday stuff. And so they can. That's what we were doing with the aeroplane. We were putting the aeroplane, a generic model of the aeroplane, and we were then
tumbling it
and saying, I was saying, that looks a bit clunky. Because what it is, it's many moments put together, which is like Brancusi talking about movement in sculpture. You know, film is many moments put together, the old stock and Android film. What you go is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, 50 stages of getting something to move. 50, you know, single frame shots of a dancer leaping in the air, and then you put them together and you just keep filling in the gaps, and then you end up with the form. And that's what the program, in a clunky way of describing it, is doing.
Yeah.
It's basically giving you that, and then you fill it all in, and it gives you a movement. On the computer, that tumble takes about 15 seconds to watch. It just goes...
Yeah.
And up and away. A very optimistic up and away at the end.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't without, you know, I mean, we had to take on board all sorts of things, longevity, cleaning, maintenance, making sure people can't climb on it or access it or touch it. Then there's wayfinding. You can't put something in the way of entrance, exit, way, fire exit. You've got to look at all of that as well. So you've got to weave the thing in there to work.
That's something you wouldn't even
consider.
I mean, you obviously would, because you've done it several times.
Yeah.
But... You know, when you first get brought up with that, you're like, oh, fucking hell.
You know,
it feels like everything's getting in your way, doesn't it? Everything's getting in your way. I was going to say, one of the final things I've got on here is, where can people find you? Website, social media, but...
Yeah. You know, that's what, well, social media I'm very bad on. I mean, I'm just getting into WhatsApp, only because my brothers and sisters, you know, siblings. You know, my mum's getting very old now. In her 90s, so I do WhatsApp that way, but some people have discovered it, so I'm getting messages from people on WhatsApp. but anybody who wants to see can go to my website. You can either just go Richard Wilson Sculptor and put that in to Google and I'll come up. If you put Richard Wilson, you're always going to get the comedian first, then I'm second. But my website is there. It's
www. You're not the only RA Richard Wilson either, are you?
I'm not even RA. No,
there was another RA.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, finest painter of bricks and mortar. In fact, well, I've got one of his catalogues. I went into a bookshop years ago and I saw a book up on the shelf saying Richard Wilson, and I knew it was the artist. He was a painter.
Yeah.
And he liked his fruit juice. I think he died in alcoholic, actually, unfortunately.
When I put it in last night, actually, and I put your name with RA at the end, and he came up, and I thought, I saw the date of birth. I thought, well, he's doing well. He's looking all right for his age.
He's got longevity, that lad.
Well, Richard, that's all my questions asked.
No, it's been fantastic, Gary. It's good to catch up again. You know, it's been a while, isn't it, man? You know.
Loved it. Thank you, mate.
I'll show you downstairs and...
Please do.
You know, I'll show you.
There you have it, Richard Wilson. I told you that was going to be something special, didn't I? And the benefit of recording a podcast during a studio visit rather than over Zoom is that you get a little sneak peek into the projects the artist is working on. And that is said without trying to sound too smug. It was quite hard not to come across a little bit fanboy in this episode. I mean, anyone that has actually visited Richard Sump Oil Installation 2050 cannot deny that it's probably one of their favourite art experiences. Because it seems to have everything. It's theatrical, you've got that deep smell of the sump oil. And if you haven't seen it, make sure you do if you get the opportunity. It really is one not to be missed. Getting to a little bit of my self-promotion. I'm selling a limited edition of 30 barbed wire stars in various colours, which go under the title of Dark Stars. They're handmade, hand-painted, and in an edition of just 30. You can see them on the Instagram page at Mizog Art, MIZOGART, or Ministry of Arts org. You can pre-order now at £85 plus £10 UK post and packaging. From November the 1st, they will be £99 with £10 UK post and packaging. Plenty of artists have got these from an edition I'd done last year. Gavin Turk has got one. Marcus Harvey's got one. Ben Ein, Emily Malice, Carrie Reichart. So that's £85 pre-order up until November the 1st. Then they go up to £99 plus £10 UK postage. At the start of this episode, I also mentioned a new art podcast that is airing on the 20th of October. It's hosted by art historian Joe McLaughlin and is entitled Joe's Art History. And if I can just read you just a little passage on Joe herself, you'll realise why I'm looking forward to this podcast so much. Joe believes stimulating art historical content should be available to everyone, and feels that presenting and writing in a fun and relaxed way will help break down the traditional elitism around the subject, which so many often find off-putting. Joe is incredibly passionate about this topic and is determined to change the long-standing idea that in order to study or enjoy the arts, you need a top education and be cut from a certain cloth. Art is for all. Hear, hear, Joe McLaughlin. That's Joe's Art History podcast coming out on the 20th of October. Well, that's about it for this week. So like I say every week, on whichever platform you're listening to this podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. So, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da. I don't believe it.